Welcome to Walking in Faith, featuring interviews and reviews that help you rediscover the Catholic faith in our culture. And now here is your host, Barbara Schenkel.
Welcome to Walking in Faith. We have a great show this week. I was recently at the Humanae Vitae 50 conference in Washington, D.C., and the keynote speaker there was our very own Archbishop Charles Chaput. He gave a great opening introduction to this conference. So I'm going to bring you that talk in its entirety right now. And then following his talk, there was a great overview of the legal decisions that brought contraception into this country. And it was given by Helen Alvarez. Many of you know her as the founder of Women Speak for Themselves. She's also a very close friend of Charles Chaput. So I'll bring you both of those talks right now.
Well, President Garvey said, I'm the chair of the Bishop's Committee on Laity. I have to get this in order, marriage, family life, and youth. And that is one of the organizing groups for this time together this week, and probably the reason why I was chosen to give the keynote talk, which I'll do in just a moment. Before doing that, I'd like to acknowledge the presence of Father Robert McCreary, who was my teacher of theology up the hill back in 1968, when all of this was going on here at Catholic University. Father McCreary taught me all I know. So, Bob, thank you very much for being here. It makes me nervous actually giving a talk in your presence. So, so thank you very much for what you've done for the church through the years. So I'll get busy about my text. I'll try to pay attention to it so I don't go on too long. 30 years ago, in remarks to brother bishops, Joseph Ratzinger noted that life in the modern church comes with a recurring litany of complaints. The complaints are familiar. They never vary. They target the Catholic teaching on contraception, sexual morality, and the nature of conscience and freedom. And each individual complaint rests on a commonly shared desire for, quote, a much more far-reaching change of paradigms about the basic ideas of being and human obligation, end of quote. As a result, over time, said Ratzinger, some key elements of the Catholic faith have witnessed a kind of reduction, a reduction in confidence and zeal, which has gradually been preparing the way for another paradigm, end of quote. It's a new and quite different paradigm that would, quote, confer the aura of morality upon changed norms of behavior, more accurately labeled as a surrender of moral integrity, end of quote. Not much has changed in 30 years, or in the 50 years since Humanae Vitae. But neither has the truth changed about the dignity of human life, the nature of human person, the beauty of marriage, and the purpose of human sexuality. So we're here together tonight to celebrate the Catholic proclamation that truth, goodness, and beauty go together, and they're experienced with the greatest joy and freedom in obedience to the Word of God and the enduring wisdom of the Church. This is the paradigm for believing Christians, and it's the only paradigm that matters. Men and women fall in love with each other because they see the reflection of God's beauty and goodness in each other, body, mind, and soul. God is a communion of persons united in a love so fruitful that it overflows into the created world. That world gives glory to God and reflects his attributes, especially that crown of creation, human beings. We're uniquely created in the image and likeness of God. God has therefore made our love fruitful, like his own, and called us to take part in the creation of new life. Many otherwise good and decent people today are blind to this good news, so remembering a few simple facts is important. In 1960, the Food and Drug Administration, the FDA, approved the first birth control pill for release to the general public. Supporters argued that the pill would strengthen marriages by allowing couples to rationally space their children. Children would be enriched by more attention and love from their parents. Financial strains would ease. Families would flourish. Demand for the new pill was heavy and immediate. Paul VI, a good pope, set up a commission to advise him on whether the historic Christian rejection of contraceptives would apply to the new technology. After study and discussion, the commission advised that it would not. In other words, most members found the pill to be morally legitimate. A few commissioners voiced disagreement. They included Karol Wojtyła, the Cardinal Archbishop of Krakow, but they were in the minority. What happened next is very well known. In his 1968 encyclical, Humanae Vitae, Paul VI taught that the pill was, in fact, a form of prohibited birth control. As a result, many Catholic clergy, scholars, and laypersons, much of that led right here at Catholic University, simply refused to accept the decision. And that resistance continues in our own day. Humanae Vitae revealed a deep wound in the church about our understanding of the human person, the nature of sexuality and marriage as God created it. We still seek the cure for those wounds. But thanks to the witness of St. John Paul II, Pope Benedict, Pope Francis, and many other faithful shepherds, the church has continued to preach the truth of Jesus Christ about who we are and what God desires for us. People willing to open their eyes and their hearts to the truth will see the hope that Catholic teaching represents and the power that comes when the truth makes us free. This evening, I want to focus on three things. First, I want to look at the emergence of Christianity in Rome and how the gospel changed pagan society's view of the human person. Second, I want to examine the signs of our own times. We're living in a new kind of pagan society. We need to understand our culture's topography so that the church can fruitfully respond to it. And third, I want to consider Humanae Vitae's teachings and prophecies, the ways in which Blessed Paul VI called us to lives of self-giving and self-denial, and his predictions if our society refused to take up that call. Many people today dismiss the Catholic view of sexuality as an oddity, or worse. It's an unhealthy thorn in the side of our enlightened culture. We're scolded, even by critics within the church, that we focus too much on the pelvic issues. The battles over sex compete with and obscure more urgent parts of the gospel, like care for the poor, or so the argument goes. As a bishop for 30 years, I can tell you that in every diocese I've served, and that's three of them, the church has put far more money, time, and personnel into the care and education of the underprivileged than into programs related to sex. And it's not that critics don't know this. Many don't want to know it because facts interfere with their storyline of a sexually repressed, body-denying institution locked in the past. I'll get to the ironies in that reasoning in a moment. My point is, the church believes what she believes about human sexuality because of what she believes about the meaning and dignity of the human person as a whole. We care for the poor and work against injustices like human trafficking for the same reasons we believe that sexual love is reserved for marriage between men and women who are open to children. For proof, we can look to some contrasts from the world in which Christianity arose. I'll draw on the work of Kyle Harper, a professor of classics and provost at the University of Oklahoma. In ancient Greece and Rome, society divided into men and women of status who had honor In ancient Greece and Rome, society divided into men and women of status who had honor and those who had none. Aristocratic women were told to reserve their chastity for marriage. Aristocratic men were expected to have sex as they pleased, ideally in moderation and discreetly. Slaves and prostitutes existed to meet the needs of their masters and clients. Professor Harper writes that the austere classical philosophers and more promiscuous Romans both, quote, presumed that sex was just sex, one instinctual need among others to be channeled in certain fundamental ways, end of quote. Prostitutes and slaves were safety valves. They were a way to release pent-up energies for freeborn men. This isn't so alien to the way many think about sex and pornography in our own society. The 5th century bishop, Salvian, summed up Roman sexual policy as forbidding adulteries but building brothels. This regime rested on exploiting the weak, a fact that Romans couldn't see, because Rome lacked any sense of the innate dignity of all human beings. Harper notes that, quote, none of the classical political regimes, nor any of the classical philosophical schools, regarded human beings as universally free and incomparably worthy creatures. Classical civilization, in short, lacked the concept of human dignity, end of quote. This changed drastically with the rise of Christianity. Christians welcomed all new life as something holy and a blessing. They argued that all human beings, Jews and Gentiles, Greeks, slaves and free, men and women, were made in the image and likeness of God. The new faith held that men and women were not simply souls trapped in bodies. They were unity of body and soul, in soul bodies and embodied souls. In other words, your body isn't just a bag of flesh, or in today's much more cynical terms, animated meat or wetware. It's more than just raw material for your own use or those of others. Your body is part of who you are and the expression of your being. Christians preach that the world is not subject to the course of the planets. It doesn't depend on the whims of fate. Rather, God has given all women and men free will, the power to act in accord with God's commands or against them. Christianity embedded that notion of free will in human culture for the first time. Christian sexual morality was a key part of this understanding of free will. The body was a consecrated space in which we could choose or reject God. Christians, therefore, demanded care for the vulnerable, all those who were weak in society. The first recorded opposition to slavery as an institution in history comes from Gregory of Nyssa. Christianity likewise created the category of the poor as a group of people whose material poverty contradicts their dignity as human beings. And Christians preached that the bodies of slaves and prostitutes did not exist for the sexual gratification of masters and paying clients. In other words, early Christians saw their faith, including its understanding of sexuality, as a message of freedom and new life in Jesus Christ, not repression. Sexual morality was part of the proclamation of a half-hidden story of God's restoration of the created cosmos, Professor Harper concludes. It was and remains integral to the Christian vision of redemption, because it is a logical outgrowth of that vision, not a tumor we can safely excise. One part of that early Christian understanding of sex was contraception. As with abortion, the early church rejected contraception. The fact that Christians did not use contraception or expose unwanted children to the elements to die set them apart from their fellow Romans. Christian opposition to contraception was universal throughout the Middle Ages and the Reformation era. It remained so until 1930. In that year, the Lambeth Conference of Anglican Bishops wrote that while the preferred method of limiting birth should be abstinence, quote, nevertheless, in those cases where there is such a clearly felt moral obligation to limit or avoid parenthood, and where there is a morally sound reason for avoiding complete abstinence, the conference agrees that other methods may be used, provided that this is done in the light of the same Christian principles." End of quote. The Lambeth bishops went on to note their strong condemnation of the use of any methods of contraception for motives of selfishness, luxury, or mere convenience, or as a means of population control. They condemned the sinful practice of abortion and sex outside of marriage. They also urged restriction on the purchase of contraceptives. The Anglican bishops at Lambeth thought they could remove one seemingly small part of Christian teaching to accommodate modern culture, while keeping the rest of it intact. History shows they were wrong. Their minor tweak gradually turned into a full reversal on the issue of contraception, and other Christian leaders followed suit. Today, this leaves the Catholic Church almost alone as a body of Christian believers whose leaders still maintain the historic Christian teaching on contraception. The Church can thus look stubborn and out of touch for not adjusting her beliefs to the prevailing culture, but she's simply remaining true to the faith she received from the apostles and can't barter that away. Since Lambeth, developed society has moved sharply away from Christian faith and morals without shedding them completely. To borrow a thought from Chesterton, we're surrounded by fragments of Christian ideas removed from their original framework and used in strange new ways. Human dignity and rights are still popular concepts, but just don't ask what their foundation is or whether human rights have any solid content beyond sentiment or personal preference. Our culture isn't reverting to the paganism of Rome, the paganism of the past. It's creating a new religion to replace Christianity. It's vital that we understand that today's new sexual mores are part of this larger change. As Professor Harper notes, quote, "In our secular age, just as in the early years of Christianity, differences in sexual morality are really about the clash between different pictures of the universe and the place of the individual within it," end of quote. Much of the moral conflict, broken family life, social unraveling, and gender confusion that seems so common today stems directly or more subtly from our disordered attitudes towards creation and our appetite to master, reshape, and even deform nature to our wills. We want freedom to decide what reality is, and we insist on the power to make it so. Human beings have a very long and imaginative record when it comes to sins of the flesh. But our most recent dysfunctions about sex began with treating human fertility as a disease. They live on in the tragedy of children whose sex is altered by a cocktail of hormones and scalpels. For Christians, this modern hatred of the body, because hatred is exactly what it is, and the desire to master and transcend the body's limitations, attack the heart of our humanity. Earlier, I mentioned the irony of critics who dismiss Christian sexual morality as repressive. The irony is this: beneath all of today's enlightened talk about liberating human sexual behavior is a contempt for the weakness and inefficiency of the flesh. The body is a defective machine. It gets fat, it gets old, it gets sick, then it dies. It can't do what my will demands of it. The body is a prison that needs to be smashed and rebuilt to new designs. The result is familiar. It's history's latest episode of Gnosticism with a new script, a new cast, and better sets. But the story is always the same: a hatred of the limits imposed by mortal flesh and blood. Therein lies a key contrast. As a congregation for the doctrine of the faith, speaking for Pope Francis, stressed just last month in Placuit Deo, this is a quote. Gnosticism associates itself with a negative view of the created order, which is understood as a limitation on the absolute freedom of the human spirit. Consequently, salvation is understood as freedom from the body and from the concrete relationships in which a person lives. But true salvation, contrary to being a liberation from the body, also includes a sanctification. The human body was shaped by God, who inscribed within it a language that invites the human person to recognize the gifts of the Creator and to live in communion with one's brothers and sisters. End of quote. Respect for the human body and the purpose of its sexual expression is fundamental to the Christian worldview. Unlike the Gnostics, ancient and modern, we believe that God created us male and female for a good and holy reason. Ordering ourselves to that purpose leads us to joy. And God became incarnate in the person of Jesus to redeem us, body and soul. Pope Francis warns that our desire for mastery and autonomy has created a human crisis similar to the crisis of our natural environment. In our day, he says, quote, marriage and the family are in crisis. We now live in a culture of the temporary, in which more and more people are simply giving up on marriage as a public commitment. This revolution in manners and morals has often flown the flag of freedom, but in fact, it has brought spiritual and material devastation to countless human beings, especially the poorest and most vulnerable. End of quote. Francis also notes how this seemingly progressive culture functions religiously. He warns against the ideological colonization of the third world countries and the polite persecution that Christians in the first world face when they dissent from the new sexual orthodoxies. As Francis has made clear, we need to resist these new orthodoxies if we want to be faithful to Jesus Christ. And that brings us back to Humanae Vitae, the first sharp challenge by the Church to what was then called the new morality. Humanae Vitae is remembered for the great no that Paul VI uttered, and rightly so. But we often forget that his no came only after an even more powerful yes to the beauty of marital love. Pope Paul begins Humanae Vitae by noting four key elements of married love. Married love is human. It's an act of the free will by which a man and woman are joined, body and soul, in a communion of life. It's also total, a gift of one's whole self, one's whole life. It's also faithful, a gift made exclusively to one person until death. And marriage is finally fruitful, overflowing to new life, like the love of God in whose image we are made. Paul VI argues that marriage is not just a social convention we've inherited, but the design of God himself. Christian couples are called to welcome the sacrifices that God's design requires so that they can enter into the joys it offers. This means that while husbands and wives may take advantage of periods of natural infertility to regulate the birth of their children, they can't actively intervene to stamp out the fertility that's natural to sexual love. Pope Paul saw that the Church's teaching often hadn't been followed in the years prior to Humanae Vitae, so he offered four predictions of the future if that trend continued. Each of his warnings has come true in ways more tragic than he could imagine. First, Paul said that the widespread use of contraception would lead to, quote, conjugal infidelity and the general lowering of morality. Obviously, the pill isn't the only factor in creating our current sexual confusions, but clearly it has had a massive effect. Look around today. Our young people are drowning in pornography. STIs and family breakdown are not only on the rise, they've seen a collateral cost to what we know to be true freedom. Second, Paul warned that men would lose respect for women, viewing them as instruments of selfish enjoyment and no longer as revered and beloved companions. Turn on the radio or television and see how this has played out. And look at the growing list of men who fall from the peak of their careers because of decades of sexual predation. Popular culture glorifies sexual coercion and physical abuse in a way unthinkable just a few decades ago. Read the studies of today's sexual relationships and accounts of the hookup culture in our cities and on our campuses. As I wrote in a pastoral letter on Humanae Vitae 20 years ago, according to Pope Paul, contraception might be marketed as liberating for women, but the real beneficiaries of birth control pills and devices would be men. Many feminists have attacked the Catholic Church for her alleged disregard of women, but the Church in Humanae Vitae identified and rejected sexual exploitation of women years before that message entered the cultural mainstream. In other words, Paul VI was right. Third, Paul warned that the widespread use of contraception would license public authorities to advocate and implement birth control as a form of population policy. This is precisely what's happened. As my brother bishops in the developing world can confirm, Western countries often tie their aid money to contraceptives, abortion, and sterilization. As Pope Francis said, a kind of ideological colonization and a way of keeping the wrong people from having more babies. Fourth and lastly, Paul VI worried that contraception would mislead human beings into thinking they had unlimited dominion over their own bodies, relentlessly turning the human person into the object of his or her own intrusive power. Our current obsession with transgender issues simply proves his point. As a result, a deep confusion drives much of our thinking about human life today. A friend of mine, a wife and mother with an impish sense of humor, refers to the pill as America's chemical corset. A curious thought. My own sister, I suspect, like a lot of modern women, would look back on corsets as an annoying museum piece, uncomfortable, antiquated, and quite literally restrictive. They were a way to control and reshape women's bodies to fit the expectations of society, especially men. But contraception works in much the same way. First, it presupposes that a woman's body should work like a man's in order for a woman to flourish and be free. Second, because a woman's body does not work like a man's, it says that her fertility and biological rhythms are problems and weaknesses. In effect, a disease that needs to be managed, like cancer or a chemical imbalance. Thus, we get a paradox. Millions of women make sure they avoid meat with hormones and take care to use plastic sparingly. Many of these same women also fill themselves with hormones and put plastic coils inside their bodies to thwart their natural fertility. And yet it's the church, not the pharmaceutical industry with its profits in manufactured infertility, or the doctors who deal with the pill's collateral health damage, or the abortion industry that cashes in lavishly on the failures of contraception, but the church that gets criticized as abnormal and intrusive. Nothing speaks more nakedly to doublethink, which we now accept as a natural rhythm in our lives. I'll close with just a couple of final thoughts. The boomer generation, my own cohort that came of age at the time of Humanae Vitae, inherited a moral framework that gave us a sense of order and meaning, even as we rejected it. Liberated sex was seen as life-giving, organic, and a source of more generous, less confining love. Humani Vitae was seen as just one more effort to bottle up the energy and freedom of young people. As late as the 1980s, much of our popular entertainment still showed casual sex as affectionate, healthy, and fun, with few, if any, consequences. Today, film and television dramas are very different. They're far more wounded and vastly more cynical. Lena Dunham's cable series Girls and the short story Cat Person, published by the New York Magazine, and the media uproar it created, are just two of the most obvious examples. The Me Too movement, emotional wreckage, sexual disease, and date rape are the realities we've inherited from the sexual revolution. Paul VI would not be surprised. Half a century after Humani Vitae, the church in the United States is at a very different, but also a very promising moment. Difficult, because the language of Catholic moral wisdom is alien to many young people, who often leave the church without ever really encountering her. But it's also promising, because the most awake of those same young people want something better and more enduring than the emptiness and noise they now have. Our mission, as a church, as always, is not to surrender to the world as it is, but to feed and ennoble the deepest yearnings of the world, and thereby lead it to Jesus Christ and his true freedom and joy. So we come together in fellowship in this conference. As we do so, may God guide us fruitfully in pursuing the task of proclaiming the joy of the gospel and the truth of Humani Vitae. Thank you very much.
And we'll be back right after the station identification. You are listening to Holy Spirit Radio, 1570 AM in Doylestown and 1420 AM in Coatesville and Chester County.
We would understand. You are the rock of salvation, the only foundation, Lord of all. You are our hope never failing, a mighty fortress.
And now from the Humani Vitae Conference in Washington, here is lawyer Helen Alvarez.
So as one of the few lawyers in the room, I've decided to be Socratic, pedantic, and legalistic. I hope that's okay. No, actually, I'm going to take you on a whirlwind tour of how, while it is that the law could not alone have catapulted contraception to the iconic status that it has today, it really did play a very important role, and I want to outline that for you. It was never done vis-a-vis some passage of a law and then deduction from that law as to the role it would play. It was always, from the very beginning, a normative enterprise. The state intended to not only make laws about contraception or to make it available, but to assert certain values that were associated with it and to make very normative claims. So they have made the normative claims that it's a key to women's health, a magic wand against poverty and even against racial divisions, that it would take care of all the economic divisions that were associated with divisions between races, that it would be the bedrock source of women's social, economic, physical, psychological, and I could go on, equality, because it would leave them alone to make choices, okay? And being alone and an individual was the normative status for being free. So I'm going to unpack this history of the law and its norm speaking, not by a chronological march through the laws, but rather by doing three themes so I can convey what the state thought it was doing and the norms it was conveying. So these themes are three. First, the shift in U.S. policy from a concern in the beginning to promote the physical, economic, health, and welfare of women and children, all the way to where we are today, which is contraception as a key part of the message that sex is the most important part of human freedom. Sexual expression indifferent to marriage and completely severed from the possibility of children. That's the value. And I will parse the law on that for you. At the same time, the state has always and everywhere maintained the value of reducing the number of children born to teenage and poor women. And during the population bomb fears, just reducing the number of children generally. The second theme is the role of law in constitutionalizing, the role of the law that constitutionalized contraception in constitutionalizing abortion, constitutionalizing same-sex sexual relations in the Lawrence case, which I'll mention, and eventually constitutionalizing same-sex marriage. And third, the role of contraception law in today's complete absence of law welcoming the woman with children into the public square, because it sucked all the oxygen out of the feminist room. Everything else that women wanted was left by the wayside. So the first theme, the shift in policy goals. I'm going to take you in a little bit of chronological march from the beginning policy goals to today. In the beginning, the early contraception laws were put out by someone who actually was a U.S. postal inspector, eventually Anthony Comstock. The Comstock laws in the 1870s, first at the federal level, which concentrated on things you could and could not mail in the federal postage, to Comstock laws at the state level, which banned use, transport, and then aiding and abetting use of everything from porn to abortion to contraception. And why were these laws put in place? The point was not just a straight out moral purpose to curb non-marital sex, but just like the laws against cohabitation, against fornication, non-marital sex, and against adultery, lest you think the state was being really, really moral at that time, a large part of the reason was also not to have children dissociated from the support of a mother and father. I mean, the state, I try to tell my students this and they sometimes don't get it, the state does not really care about your romance. It cares about the romance of same-sex couples. It actually does. And you look at the language in Lawrence and Obergefell, and it's very emotional and romantic language. It does not care about the romance of people who can produce children. Regarding those persons, it wants to make sure that there is a mother and a father with a support obligation. Okay, and so it wanted to curb non-marital birth. And all those laws, including the Comstock laws, were for that. Most of these laws were gone or unenforced by the 50s, with the exception of Massachusetts and Connecticut, which had Comstock laws state level on their books. This is where we get the 1965 case of Griswold versus Connecticut. Just the other night on C-SPAN, for all of the super cool people among you, I did a 1.5-hour live dialogue on Griswold. And it was always, people would call in, they're like, I have to say, I'm a lawyer. And I'm like, you're totally boring, I could tell. You're not watching the NCAA finals. You're here with me doing the Griswold case. Anyway, Griswold in 1965 is where the modern law gets started. But even before that, you'll be fascinated to know that the very first federal involvement in contraception was when Margaret Sanger persuaded Eleanor Roosevelt that in order to keep women working in the factories without VD and without babies during the World War II, that the Fed should provide women in the factories contraception. And they did. Very, very instrumental, right, for the man. For the production of the defense industry, contraception. But the next really important development was in the Griswold case. And here I have to explain the case, but a wee bit of constitutional law. So Griswold, there's no right of contraception in the Constitution. So when Connecticut comes and says, let's overturn Connecticut's ban, it's not like there is a superior law, the federal constitution, that had a clear text that could say to Connecticut, I'm sorry, contraception is a constitutional right. What the majority in that case did was say that there are penumbras and emanations. There are indications from the first eight amendments of the Bill of Rights that there is such a thing called a right of privacy. It doesn't appear in the Constitution, but it's there in your right not to quarter soldiers, or your right to not to incriminate yourself, or your rights to avoid warrantless search and seizures. Okay, so it's there. The dissent in that case, which ultimately led to the law we have today, said the 14th Amendment to the Constitution. You may remember one of the post-Civil War amendments has a right of liberty. And we hold in the dissent that this right of liberty includes things that are deeply rooted in this nation's history and tradition, implicit in the concept of order and liberty, such that neither liberty nor justice would exist if we did not announce these rights and protect them. What this means is anytime 5 out of 9 people on the Supreme Court find one of these, it is the highest right. Nothing federal can contradict it, and nothing at the state level. No state constitution, no state law can contradict it. And 5 out of 9 people on the court simply have to declare that it exists. The safeguard there is it has to be a long history and tradition that supports it. Okay? So, for instance, you may feel differently when you find out that your right to send your kids to Catholic schools or to have them taught a foreign language is not in the Constitution, but it was found in the Liberty Clause of the 14th Amendment. Why? Well, they said it's just so much a part of our history and tradition that parents control their children's education. So you may like some of these liberty rights, and you may dislike others. The safety valve, Justice Scalia says, has everything in our history and tradition led us to say, oh, the government can't take that right away, including parents' right to educate their children. Of course, you know, abortion was banned, but they found it anyway. Same-sex marriage did not exist anywhere, and 31 or 34 states had banned it in a row, and the Supreme Court still said, it's in our history and tradition. So obviously they do what they please. It's the whatever constitution where the 14th Amendment is concerned nowadays. But that doesn't mean there aren't some valid uses of this. Well, that was the dissent in Griswold, and it later became the source of all these other rights. And remember, because it's put in that liberty phrase, these are rights of enormous social and legal importance. They're called substantive due process rights when you pull them out of the 14th Amendment. Okay, this is what contraception enjoys. Okay, that level of importance. There would be no freedom without it. It is a crucial part of our history and tradition. That's the right it enjoys. To proceed chronologically with the laws, Johnson comes in the 1960s and decides that contraception is a ticket to poverty reduction. So he sets up family planning centers at the time at NIH. Now they're handled by the Department of Health and Human Services. In the 1960s, Nixon goes whole hog in on this, not just domestically, but also internationally. And I'm sure many of you are familiar with the famous National Security Memorandum of Nixon, number 200, where he says, we have to contracept the third world. We need their minerals. If they have too many people, there's going to be social unrest. And let's convince everyone in the third world that their leaders want it so we don't appear to be coercive. If you have any thought that even coercive contraception policy is the purview of the Democrats, just go read yourself some Nixon, okay? So, in fact, the other night when I was doing the Griswold show, one of the things that was fascinating is the plaintiff is a very, Mount Holyoke girl, married to a State Department guy who is a Yalie. The lawyer, Republican royalty from the state of Connecticut, Yale. All the lawyers involved, Yale. You know, it was a white Republican movement. And when they interview these doctors and the doctors say, hey, wealthy women can get contraception, but we have to make sure the poor can get it because these are the people who really need it. okay? So don't think it's bipartisan, okay? Then you have 1970, Title 10, which was intended not only to address poverty, but also what they perceived to be overpopulation, again, among poor people. Currently, Title 10 spends $2.1 billion, not Title 10, excuse me, the feds, Title 10, Medicaid, and other programs, $2.1 billion annually just from the feds on contraception itself. The states add another $225 million. Annually. So it's 2.3 a year. The push in the feds now is long-acting reversible contraception. I don't know if any of you saw the really scary guidance under the Obama administration where they said in Medicaid letters to the states, listen, when women who are on Medicaid, read poor women, come in, make sure that you say, okay, we're delivering the baby now. Here's your IUD, okay, I'm just gonna put it in now, okay? Make sure you have them on hand, and that the minute the woman comes in about her pregnancy, you start talking to her about the IUD insertion. And it's the Medicaid population, so it is disproportionately poor and minority. Make sure you do it. LARCs are still controversial, but they're a huge push from the Obama administration. I don't think they have widespread acceptance yet, although I know it's growing. And there is even some queasiness among the left on this. When the Brookings Institute got together with the American Enterprise Institute to talk about poverty reduction, the American Enterprise Institute refused to go along with long-acting reversible contraception. And these are some pretty, these are Republicans who stay away from the culture issues. And even though Brookings ultimately did, there's some misgiving because in the literature, poor and minority women say, you're basically sterilizing us for 3 to 10 years, and we think it's racial. Currently, it is no longer about poverty reduction. It is screaming women's rights 24/7. And the best evidence of this was what we all know as the contraception mandate. They didn't even, I mean, they tried to make this veneer-sized case that this was about women's health. For those of you who really want to see, I think, the big undoing of that, I did a like 70-page single-spaced article where I took, and it's in the Villanova Law Review on my SSRN page, and I took every medical source cited in the Institute of Medicine report that the feds relied on, and completely, and I don't, not all my articles are this like slam dunk, this is slam dunk, completely undid the feds' medical argument. The real argument there was, if women do not will a child, then she should not have a child. Their attempt to link unintended pregnancy to smoking or violence or obesity fell afoul of every rule in statistics about selection effects or which one was the cause and which one was the effect or confounding factors, when all the literature shows that unintended pregnancy doesn't cause women to smoke, get beat, or start drinking. In fact, it's the third factor of women who are risk takers, who both have unintended pregnancies and tend toward these other behaviors, is what the literature actually showed. I mean, their material was so poor. Then they claim it reduces poverty and abortion, and if you looked at their data, you can see that unintended pregnancies and out-of-wedlock pregnancies have actually gone up 50 and 1,200% precisely among the poor since Title X went into effect. It was almost too easy to undo. So they're not making a serious health argument. They can't make a serious anti-poverty argument because poor women have suffered the most since free contraception, in terms of the retreat from marriage, the rise in unintended pregnancies, and the rise in out-of-wedlock births. So what they really were making is the argument, unintended pregnancy, a pregnancy a woman does not will, is freedom for women. So we have to get rid of unintended pregnancy. I could go on about that article, and I'll be happy to point you to it when we talk later. The other way that the feds and the state laws have moved away from we can protect the health of women all the way to, or excuse me, health of women and anti-poverty, all the way to sexual expression without children and indifferent to marriage is freedom, is through the partners that the feds have had Planned Parenthood is one, and you know their material well. One I want to bring your attention to more, it used to be called the National Campaign to Prevent Teen and Unplanned Pregnancy. They changed their name to Power to Decide recently. I'd like to think I had a little something to do with that, because NCTUP, I would always refer to them as knocked up. And just saying. And they now have a new name. So anyway, when they were knocked up, they actually, and they were on the Obama administration's HHS website as the instruction for young women. They offered young women a Frisky Friday series, offering recipes for aphrodisiac food to heat up your weekend with our sex tips and food. They offered consolation for girls depressed after hookup sex, saying, some of the most modern, empowered, secure, sexalicious women among us have had at least one walk of shame. Their e-cards and graphics for teenagers to download include photos of natural objects resembling genitalia or bondage equipment. It's About Us section that the feds would refer you to, touts a women's right to a happy, healthy sex life without worrying about pregnancy. It has a booty log app for your phone to record your, quote, sexcapades and tell everyone about them, and urged readers to cohabit and have non-marital babies, advising, just don't feel bad about your choice if you choose not to marry but have a baby. If it's right for you, it's right. Okay, this is the federal website, HHS, linking to this partner and giving enormous quantities of money regularly to Knocked Up. My last two points, and I'm trying to end in like 4 minutes here, is the role of constitutional contraception in constitutionalizing abortion, then sodomy, and the Texas law was called an anti-sodomy law, so I'm not using a language that the law did not, and the same-sex marriage. It's a familiar story how laws constitutionalizing contraception did this. In fact, I was on a panel at Yale Law School not too long ago, and there's a guy who's their family law professor now. He is a openly gay law professor. He used to run gay law for the university, I think it was UCLA or Berkeley, and now he's Yale's family law professor. And I was arguing about a children's rights perspective on Obergefell, and he said to me, let's face it, all of those cases that came before that said that what the Supreme Court was valuing was sexual expression without children. It was you all, it was heterosexuals and their demands for contraception and abortion that paved the way for Obergefell, and you know it. Couldn't discount that. The trajectory can be briefly summarized. What are the mediating factors linking contraception that came after it? First, 1972, Eisenstadt versus Baird says that the right of contraception is not something that inheres in married people or the married bedroom, but it's a right to decide really important things about your life, like how many kids you want to have, married or single. It said, marriage is not a unit. It's two individual people making private decisions inside their head, and the right of privacy guaranteed by the Constitution is between each of their sets of ears, okay? Then it was also linked with, the right of privacy was linked with sex without children and completely indifferent to marriage in the Roe versus Wade opinion, where the court was addressing single or married women and giving them a right to abortion based on the right of privacy, citing both Griswold and Eisenstadt. In Lawrence versus Texas, where the Supreme Court made sodomy a federal constitutional right, and in the Obergefell opinion, constitutionalizing same-sex marriage, they focused on individual decisions in the heads of people that were fundamental to their identity creation as the definition of the right of privacy. In Obergefell, the court cites the contraception cases when it says, the fundamental liberties protected by the 14th Amendment's Due Process Clause extend to personal choices central to individuals' dignity and autonomy, including intimate choices defining personal identity and beliefs. Do you hear anything in there about partners, pairs, married couples? The right of privacy is a right to decide your own identity, your own beliefs. It's for one person at a time, which is very ironic to see in a case about marriage, isn't it, right? So avoiding children, which had already been linked with substantive due process level goods, made it perfectly simple for the Obergefell court to conclude that states could no longer argue that they had any interest in, let alone favoring for, procreative couples or linking those couples with their children. In fact, Obergefell stands for the proposition that states are forbidden from valuing procreation, procreative couples, or linking children with their kin. They are forbidden from giving that any special value. Final point, the role of contraception in the continuing absence of laws welcoming women and children to the public square. The contraception cases communicated that being without children is a good that many wish to achieve. The contraception mandate says it is women's highest good, and all women should understand this, okay? Contraception law also reinforces the idea that the way to achieve freedom is to be by yourself. Abortion cases do the same thing. Lawrence and Obergefell even talk about rights to do something with a partner, whether sex or marriage, but as creating your identity. You choose this expression because it shapes you. So freedom in connection with sexual expression is all about self-creation, okay? And in the case of women, it's about making yourself equal to men by being able to have sex with no childbirth like men and then enter the public square in that unencumbered manner. So once lawmakers and a wide swath of citizens have imbibed the notion that women's chief freedom is the power to avoid children, this completely quashes the idea that citizens have duties to women who make these super private choices to have children to stand in solidarity with them. And then the final point, of course, is practically speaking, the organizations that have been in the vanguard of feminism, the ones that claim to speak for all women, which is why I helped invent Women Speak for Themselves, like, excuse me, no, there's several hundred million of us that you don't speak for. Probably billions. Just haven't been able to get outside the country with that yet. But, you know, the idea that all women stand for this and the groups that have led the fight, National Organization for Women, Planned Parenthood, if you look at their What Women Want sections, it is always contraception and abortion first. This has sucked all the oxygen out of the room that might have been devoted to questions like a family wage, a living wage, flexible work schedules, you know, parental leave, etc. Contraception and abortion, the power to be alone, not in community, has sucked it all up. And of course, who suffers the most is people who are vulnerable. Poor children suffer, poor women suffer, as nobody says to them, you have a human right to be married if that's your vocation and to have marital children. And instead, the only right the government seems eager to give them is the right to be alone with their contraception and their neighborhood abortion clinics. So I know we have a panel later. We can talk further. Thank you very much.